you ready for a whole new way of being in the world? Welcome to Living from the Inside Out with Michael Neal.
Good morning, good afternoon, good evening, wherever you may be. Our topic for today is increasing your emotional intelligence. And the numbers to call to, well, just to chat about increasing your emotional intelligence or thriving or whatever it is that you'd like to explore from the inside out are 866-254-1579, toll-free in the United States and Canada, 866-254-1579. Outside the U.S. and Canada, you can reach the show by dialing the country code followed by 760-918-4300. And I'm going to sort of set the table. I've recorded a series of videos about this, but they're not going to be available for a while. So I wanted to kind of just explore with you what seems to me to be not undervalued, because I think emotional intelligence, a lot of people do recognize the importance of it, but I would say something that is fundamentally misunderstood culturally. And I wanted to just explore it from a different point of view with you guys today. And in order to do that, let's start with, here's a couple of definitions of emotional intelligence. These are the two that I picked out as the sort of most common thematically. One is the ability to identify and manage one's own emotions as well as the emotions of others. So the ability to know what it is that you're feeling and deal with it, and to know what it is that others are feeling and deal with that. Another definition that I kind of like this one, the capacity to be aware of, control, and express one's emotions, and to handle interpersonal relationships judiciously and empathically. So I kind of like that because I don't know how valuable it really is to be able to identify an emotion, because that would suggest that they're each very different and need to be handled differently. But the capacity to be aware of, I don't love the word control, but I'm going to say work with and express one's emotions. Those are really cool things to be able to do, right? Anyone not want that? You don't want to be aware of, you know, work with and express your emotions. And I mean, if not, it's probably because your emotions seem like overwhelming monsters that you don't want to, oh my God, don't go there. But hopefully even by the end of our time together today, they're not going to look so monstrous to you. And to handle interpersonal relationships judiciously and empathically. Nope, I don't want to do that. I don't want to handle it. I want my interpersonal relationships to be awful. None of us would say that. And yet, we don't really, on the whole, societally, put that much attention on emotional intelligence other than in extremes. So we might kind of go to anger management if our anger has gotten out of control, or we might really suffer from our emotions and want to suffer less, or we might be so cut off from our emotions that we're depressed, that we have no energy, that we have no aliveness. And as you start to see what emotions are, it becomes kind of obvious what to do with them. And as it becomes more obvious to you what emotions are and what to do with them, it becomes incredibly obvious how to interact with other people around emotional subjects, around emotional things, to be in what we might call an emotional conversation without being frightened off by its emotionality. So I've always found that people tend to gravitate towards one extreme or another. So I spent my life between mostly America and the United Kingdom. And in the United Kingdom, I would say the cultural approach to emotions is they're bad and wrong and, you know, grow up and get on with it. And a nice cup of tea will take care of everything. Now, that's an extreme, obviously. My wife, who's British, her description of the American cultural view of emotions is, and this she actually asked me after we'd lived in America for about a month, and she said, why are all Americans emotionally incontinent? And again, they're not, but that's sort of just two cultural extremes. And there are different cultures around the world who have different attitudes towards emotion. So I'm not suggesting that one attitude is the right one and the other is the wrong one, and the Brits have it right and the Americans have it wrong, or the Americans have it right and the Brits have it wrong, or really we all need to be more like the Italians or the Japanese. It's just worth noting that there is not a universal agreement on the right way to be around emotion, which means probably that none of the things we think about emotions are universally true. But that doesn't mean that there isn't anything that's universally true about emotion. So if we start with the question, well, what are emotions? Well, emotions are thoughts. We think up our emotions. We ascribe meaning to things, and then based on the meaning that we've ascribed to things, we feel a certain way about them. Now, we don't do this consciously, right? It's not a rational act. We're not sitting there going, how shall I feel about this? Well, they've just slept with my brother, and they've stolen all my money. I should feel grateful? No. I should feel hopeless? Better. I should feel murderous rage. Yes, that's it. That's the correct emotion I will now feel. You know it doesn't work like that. We feel what we feel. We don't think it through, but it is made of thought. It is made of the creative energy of life. You can't feel what you don't think. Doesn't work that way. Thought is the medium through which we feel thought and consciousness, because consciousness is sort of like the movie screen on which the movie of thought plays. And we sit in the audience and we watch the movie and we react to it emotionally. Now, in and of itself, that understanding of what emotions are don't tell you what to do or not do. But they do kind of tell you where your emotions come from. And it isn't the world. It isn't even specifically the movie, because people can have completely different emotional reactions to the same movie. It is an internally generated constant variable. And it's made of the very aliveness that we all thrive on and crave. If you wanted to decide, if you were looking at two gardens and somebody said, which garden is thriving? The garden with more aliveness running through it would be the one that you would identify as thriving. If you took two human beings and said, which one is thriving? You wouldn't probably actually start by going, I don't know, let's look at their bank balances and let's look at their personal lives and let's look at their circumstances and let's make an evaluative list. You would simply see which one is more vibrant with aliveness. Which person is more consistently filled with life, and that would be the one that we would describe as thriving. So if we want to thrive, aliveness is our friend. Emotion is a manifestation of that aliveness. Emotions are flavors of aliveness. Now, we all have our preferences for certain flavors. Some people really genuinely just are more comfortable with and really fancy angry aliveness. Angry flavored aliveness. That's what they like. They feel comfortable with angry flavored aliveness. Some people, nobody would say probably that they like it. Actually, that's not even true. I was going to say nobody really says that they love stress flavored aliveness, but I've actually met a number of people who, when we're talking about stress, go, well, I mean, I don't want to get rid of my stress. I mean, I really like it. But they like it because it's what they associate with aliveness. It's like they know that flavor. Oh, it's aliveness. Okay, yeah, more stress. Now, that sounds really funny if you've spent your time trying to avoid stress. But if you look around, you'll find all sorts of people who would say, yeah, no, I thrive on stress. Now, I'm going to argue that they don't. They thrive on aliveness like all of us. And it just so happens that the only connection they have with aliveness is through the stress flavoring. And we'll explore that a little bit more as we go. But if emotions are flavors of aliveness, if they are the feeling of our thinking, and because thought changes moment by moment, our feelings, our emotions change moment by moment, and we're making them up. Again, not on purpose, but we're making them up with the same creative capacity of the mind that makes up everything. Then what do you do with them? Well, if they're just flavors of aliveness, you don't have to do anything with them. I mean, I guess you can feel them. But you would feel them anyways. That's how you know they're there. It's just we have picked up somewhere along the way a lot of habits to avoid feeling the stuff. I know I did. Right? Anyone of you who knows my story knows I spent years and years and years struggling with depression. Well, that depression, looking back on it, was me clamping down on the aliveness because the flavors it came out in, I didn't like. I didn't like anger-flavored aliveness. I didn't like fear-flavored aliveness. I didn't like stress and pressure-flavored aliveness. And because I had so much, I didn't like anxious aliveness because I had so much of that in my life. Those were the dominant flavors that came through. I just went, I'm not going to the ice cream parlor anymore. I'm just going to shut the doors on the ice cream parlor. I'm going to get really hyper-rational. I'm going to get super smart. And I was from Boston, so I'm going to get wicked smart. And I'm just going to be wicked smart, and that's what I'm going to do. And you know, those poor people who aren't smart enough and need to feel stuff, well, that's good for them. Now, I didn't get that what I was really doing was switching off the fire hose of life. I was disconnecting from the mains and trying to run on battery power. And I couldn't understand why I had less and less energy, why there was less and less coming through me, why it was so hard to even get myself out of bed in the morning, let alone engage with other people, let alone engage with life. And when I started to see that I didn't have to be afraid of my thinking, I didn't have to be afraid of my experience, I didn't have to be afraid of feeling, I started to feel more. And when I started to feel more without worrying so much about what I was feeling or why I was feeling it, because what I was feeling is aliveness with a flavor. And why was I feeling it? Because I'm alive and I think and we feel thought. Suddenly my aliveness came back and depression disappeared, because depression is just the name we have for that feeling of being blanketed, of covering over the aliveness in us, deadening ourselves to the aliveness in it, the aliveness in us. And when we open back up to it, we feel more alive. This is the same reason why so many people who have been diagnosed with bipolar disorder or manic depression will go off their meds. Because we instinctively love that feeling of aliveness, even if we hate the excesses of it. And we instinctively kind of go away from the deadness, even though we deadened ourselves with the best of possible intentions to help us feel safe, to stop us from feeling so overwhelmed. So in emotional intelligence circles, they tend to talk about five areas to look at in terms of increasing your emotional intelligence. And one of those five areas is self-awareness. So the ability to actually notice that you're alive, to actually be in on the joke, to actually see all these thoughts and feelings coming through you, to feel your aliveness, whatever flavor it happens to be in the moment. That's self-awareness. And the only reason we cut off from that awareness is because somewhere along the line, we get scared of it. One of my all-time favorite quotes, the quote I open the Inside Out Revolution with, is from Sid Banks, the Scottish mystic, if the only thing people learned was not to be afraid of their experience, was not to be afraid of their emotions. That alone would change the world. And that's been true for me. And it's not an on-off switch. It's more like a dimmer switch than an on-off switch. The more I open up to feeling feelings, the more I open up to just feeling how I feel without having to have an opinion about it or fix it or do anything about it or change the flavor, the more I can just kind of get high on my own aliveness, the more alive I am, the more I thrive, the more responsive I am to life, the more tuned in I am. So the only thing that deadens self-awareness is fear of what's going to come into our awareness. Or, and this is the sort of empowered version of it, and will take us into the second category, the second area, but the other thing that can kind of get in the way of self-awareness is that we've prejudged, we're prejudiced against certain emotions. So we either block those from awareness because we don't like the idea that we feel those things, right? Ooh, I'm not the kind of person who gets angry. Ooh, I'm not the kind of person who's scared. Ooh, I'm not the kind of person who does sad. Or I'm not the kind of person who's happy all the time. I'm not the kind of person who feels joy. I'm not the kind of person who gets carried away with things. So we don't let ourselves be aware because we don't like what we've made up, what we're aware of means about us. Not seeing that we're the ones who've made it up. Or we're so quick to try to fix it. Ooh, bad feeling, must fix. Right? Ooh, I'm angry. What do I do about my anger? Ooh, I'm scared. What do I do about my fear? How do I overcome this? How do I go beyond this? How do I not get caught up in this? Well, that's not awareness. That's reactivity. We're so quick to judge and try to change, fix, or avoid it that we never actually notice it. We never actually experience it. And in the end, we become kind of the opposite of self-aware, become kind of self-deluded. Now, you can go to another extreme. You can become too self-conscious, where you become obsessive about your feelings. It's like, oh, I'm feeling this. What does that mean? Oh, I'm feeling that. I must process this. I must feel this. Oh, I need time to feel my feelings. Well, no, you really don't. We're made to feel. We're made to feel in the midst of everything and function beautifully regardless. Like, that's what's so cool. We are made for this. And when we allow ourselves to be aware of it, that's a cool thing. That's a cool moment. That's a keeper. That's one of those moments that you'll look back on and go, huh, it didn't kill me. I felt angry and nobody died. I felt scared and nothing exploded. I felt stressed and I was still able to do a good job. I felt happy and I didn't become stupid. I felt overwhelming love and I didn't act like an idiot. Self-awareness is just awareness. There's no control in it. There's no desire for control in it. There's no insecurity in it. There's no fear of the future in it. It's just awareness. And we're made of awareness. Awareness is our nature. So here's a second area that people who teach about increasing your emotional intelligence talk about: self-regulation. Now, that smacks of control, but it doesn't actually mean control, or it doesn't have to mean control. Self-regulation is simply recognizing that you can function through any emotion. Emotions don't really stop us, they fuel us. You know, there's a cutesy thing that you'll sometimes read in self-help books about, you know, emotion is motion, and there's a kind of a truth to that, in that aliveness is motion. Aliveness is what moves our bones. Aliveness is what fills us up. Aliveness is what fuels us. And if we don't understand emotions, We need to keep them in control. We need to keep them in check. We need to self-regulate in a very ordered, controlled manner. But if your emotions are just emotions, if they're just what you are feeling in the moment, if they don't mean anything about you, if they don't mean anything about the world, if they're not telling you about your circumstances, they're telling you about your thinking in the moment, then it turns out they are already self-regulating. So this is a metaphor, what I'm about to share with you. I'm not saying it is exactly like this, but it's kind of like this. We have an emotional thermostat. And that emotional thermostat is always bringing us back to well-being. It's always bringing us back to comfort, to ease, to that sense of all being well. So if you're aware, if you're feeling your feelings, the system will automatically settle your thinking when it notices that it's gone off the rails. It will settle you down. It will lift you up when you've gotten a little dopey. It will bring you back to yourself. You will regain your bearings. But not as an act of will. It's just how the system works. You don't, because if you've got a thermostat in your home and it can actually, the thermometer works properly, then when it gets too warm, it'll cool things off. And when it gets too cold, it'll heat things up to bring it back to that kind of place of well-being, that place of, that place of home. But if you keep messing with the thermometer by going, I don't like it when the thermometer goes below this number, so I'm gonna tell myself that it's not below that number, and I'm gonna affirm that it's above that number, or I'm gonna light a fire whenever it gets cold right under the thermometer, which is what a lot of the techniques that we learn do, right? They're artificially trying to change the emotion. And it messes with the thermostat, because the thermometer for the thermostat can't get a real reading. And because it can't get a real reading, the system doesn't kick in. And because the system doesn't kick in, it reinforces our confusion that we need to do something about it. We need to regulate ourselves, as opposed to seeing that our emotional system is self-regulating and will always bring us back home if we let it. If we don't get in the way of it. I was teaching a program on money earlier today, and somebody commented about how their business had gone under, and they found themselves with a lot of debt, and that at first they were kind of, you know, rocking back and forth in the fetal position, but then they kind of found their way back to okay. Well, that's true for all of us. Whatever we get caught up in, we'll always come back. We're made to come back. The system is so freaking cool. We are so well made that as soon as it notices we're off, it starts to bring us back. But not because it's wrong to feel those things, just because we're made to thrive. And when we get too caught up in any one flavor, it starts to kind of taint the aliveness a little bit, and we get stuck in a particular channel, and we lose sight of the water, of the river, of the source. So self-awareness, well, that's natural. It's what's there until we come up with reasons not to pay attention, to avoid. Self-regulation, that's natural too. The system is self-regulating. It's not a skill we need to learn. It's just something that we need to see in action enough that we trust and that we stop trying to manipulate the system. Now, this is crazy, right? I'm on Hay House Radio. And I spent so much time over the years learning to manipulate my emotions, right? I was an NLP master trainer. And that was like my specialty, is making myself feel different. And that looked like a really good idea, A, because I hated the way I felt, and B, because I thought if I didn't, all hell would break loose. I didn't know the system was self-regulating. I'd never left it alone long enough for it to self-regulate. It's like, some of you heard this analogy, and it's a kind of an odd analogy, but it's a true story. So in the early years of my marriage, my wife told me quite often that I was really lazy and didn't help around the house and didn't care about cleanliness. And I kind of believed her, because I noticed too that I didn't really help much around the house, and that, you know, I could walk past piles of clothes without even noticing them to pick them up. And then something really interesting happened, and it happened fortunately for us. It's our anniversary this weekend, so we're 31 years and 29 years married. So we got past this, but I figured out pretty early on, she went on a business trip without me. Well, obviously, and I noticed about 3 days into her trip, I was cleaning the house. Now, I didn't decide to clean the house. I didn't think, I should clean the house. I just noticed when I was in the middle of vacuuming that I was vacuuming. I was like, huh. And I realized, oh, the house just never got dirty enough for me to notice, because my set point for cleanliness was lower than my wife's, so she would clean it before I would. Well, most of our emotional set points are much higher, much more sensitive than the systems. And so we step in to fix our emotions before the system reacts, before it even notices that anything's going on. Because of course we're feeling stuff. We're human. That's what we do. We think and we feel. Well, once I'd seen it, I stopped making up stories about it. And to this day, while I'm certainly able to, you know, step in and help out before I would do it, I know that I don't have to worry about it, that my house will always be clean one way or another. And in the same way, when you recognize that emotions are self-regulating, that our entire emotional well-being is self-regulating, we stop worrying about managing our emotions and we allow the system to take care of itself. Now, third area, motivation. We have all this emotionality around motivation. We either try to get ourselves hyped up Tony Robbins style to go out there and take on the world, or we struggle. I just can't get myself to whatever it is you think you should get yourself to. Now, there's a couple of funny things for me about that whole idea of I just can't get myself to. The first is, which one are you? Are you the one that's trying to get yourself to, or are you the self that's trying, that needs getting somewhere? Like, it splits us artificially into multiple beings, one of whom is fundamentally lazy and bad, and the other of whom is fundamentally sensible, and it immediately sets them off at war with each other. And you can see why early psychologists like Freud came up with the idea of the separate selves, the id, the ego, the superego, or in transactional analysis, you have the parent and the child. And you can recognize that in yourself, but it's simpler than that. It's not, there aren't really separate selves. It's just a way that we have of thinking of ourselves. When we start to see who we really are, and who you really are is not your name, it's not your race, it's not your religion, it's not your personal history, it's not your story. Who you really are is who you would be regardless of your story. It is that in you which would be the same if you'd grown up in a different family, in a different time, in a different body. And who you really are is untouchable by life. Who we really are is like the mirror that can reflect anything without being impacted, without being changed, without being damaged by that which it reflects. Our true nature is the perfection of life itself. So the idea that there's this little us that needs to be motivated by this big us is kind of a funky idea. It would make sense if we really were a collection of separate selves. If we really were, I remember there was an expression I wrote about in my first book, and I can't remember the acronym, but it's the me who is in charge at the moment. And it's this idea that we have all these multiple selves and we're all sort of multiple personality disorders, but it just, because they're close enough to each other, we don't diagnose ourselves with that. But that effectively, depending on, you know, who's in charge in the moment, we'll be completely different people. Again, I understand where theories like that come from, because I've had that experience of feeling like schizophrenic, like one, I'm really happy and then I'm really sad and I think this is great and I think it's awful and I really want to do this and then I don't do it. I get all that. But what if the explanation for that is simpler? What if once again, we've put an overlay on top of something that already works perfectly? And this is something that might help you get at it. If you've got kids, one of the things that you probably have dealt with at some point, if they're over a certain age, is that, wow, they just can't concentrate. They're just not motivated to do their work. You know, they have a motivation issue. They just can't get themselves to clean their rooms. I can't get them to. And yet, you notice that when there's something they really want to do, they do it. They never need a motivational talk. They never need Tony Robbins to help them go play video games or to go hang out with their friends or to draw pictures in their journals or whatever it is that they love to do, whatever it is that they know to do, whatever it is that their own inner sense of direction is guiding them towards. We use motivation because we think we know from the outside what people should do. We try to motivate ourselves because we think we know from the outside what we should be doing in order to have the things we think we need to have in order to get the feelings that we think come from having things. But if you're innately well, if your nature is pure aliveness, if you're as good as new already, if you are already the perfection of the universe in form, I don't think it particularly matters if you ate your greens and did your push-ups today. And I know for a fact that if you feel like doing push-ups, you'll do push-ups. And if you know to eat your greens, you'll eat your greens. Generally speaking, motivation is trying to get yourself to do what you fundamentally don't want to do or know to do because somebody told you or you made up that it's a good idea. But we all have intrinsic motivations. We all have an inner guidance system. We all have an inner inclination. And when we learn to follow that inclination, motivation becomes a sweet misnomer. People will say, wow, how do you get yourself to write every week? And how do you get yourself to write all those books? And how do you get yourself to do all the things that you do? And the truth is, 99.9% of the time, I don't. I'm following my inclinations. And these are the things that I'm inclined to do. Now, there are other things I used to think I should be inclined to do. There are probably things now I think I should be inclined to do. Yes, I should do more of this and I should be more like that. I go there. But it's harder and harder for me to take that seriously. It sounds more and more like personal neurosis and less like the wisdom of the ages. And so motivation isn't a problem unless we think that our inclinations are wrong, that we're fundamentally off, and that we need to be controlled. But we're not fundamentally off, we're fundamentally amazing. And we get caught up, we get carried away, we lose our bearings, and we start stumbling around like kids playing pin the tail on the donkey. But if you've ever played pin the tail on the donkey, you know if you stop spinning, the room will stop spinning a minute later. And when the room stops spinning, if you take off the blindfold, which you voluntarily put on, you'll find it pretty easy to pin the tail on the donkey. And trying to do it while you're blindfolded and spinning makes for a great party game, but a terrible life strategy. So that's in us. We increase our emotional intelligence when we recognize that awareness is our nature, and we allow ourselves to simply be aware of what's going on with us moment by moment. We increase our emotional intelligence when we let the system self-regulate and stop going in and trying to control it and manipulate it all the time. We look to other people like we really are motivated when we follow our inner inclinations and stop trying to fight against them and make ourselves do things that we're not inclined to do. So what about the other people part? So if we're talking about emotional intelligence as the capacity to be aware of, work with, and express one's emotions, and to handle interpersonal relationships judiciously and empathically, what are the areas, the skills of handling interpersonal relationships judiciously and empathically? Well, the first one is empathy. It's really difficult to connect with other people if you can't feel them. Now, I have a neighbor who is from a very fundamentalist family, religious family, and is always a little bit worried about the kinds of things that I do here at Hay House. Like, you know, don't they teach psychic stuff? I mean, you know, that's the devil's work, Michael. And I don't think that's how it works. But one day I was speaking with her, and I said, but you're psychic. And she looked horrified and said, what do you mean? And I said, well, when your husband comes home, don't you know what kind of day he's had before he says anything? And she said, well, yeah. And I said, well, that's psychic, right? And aren't there times where with your kids, you know what they're thinking, even though they haven't told you? Well, yeah. Well, that's psychic. Now, I could see that she was increasingly horrified and thought I was the devil, so I stopped that line of discussion. But my point was, we are naturally empathic. We are naturally tuned in to the people that we are spend the most time with, that we are most comfortable with. But we tend not to pay attention to that when the outcome becomes important. It's like, well, this is business. I can't afford to do that. I need to stay on my purpose. I need to stay focused on the result. Or, well, you know, I don't know. This person is just scary. I don't want to. I need to just kind of bull through this and not. We have our reasons to not take advantage of our natural empathy, but they don't stand up to much reason. When you look at it, we never do better by staying disconnected and unempathic to the people around us. Yeah, we can go a little too far with it. We can get so caught up in the feeling of other people that we think, oh my God, I need to fix that, or I need to avoid that, or that's scary that they feel so strongly, or whatever. But when you see that emotions are just emotions, they don't mean anything, they don't do anything, they're not permanent, they're not indicative of a fundamental problem. People think and then they feel. Or maybe they think and feel simultaneously. I don't really know that there's a sequence to it. We're making up our emotions, and so are they. Not on purpose, not in a way that we can control and make up better emotions, but they are made up of thought. They're made up of the creative fabric of the universe. They're made up from the Play-Doh of the universe, and they don't need to be feared. A dragon made out of Play-Doh is not scarier than a barbershop made out of Play-Doh. If we recognize that they're both made out of Play-Doh, fear is not a worse emotion than love. If we understand that they're both made out of the same stuff, the same energy, the same aliveness. And if we don't have to avoid them in ourselves, we don't have to fear them in others. And so we can take the time to get present and to tune in and to get a feel for the people that we're spending our time with. And when we do that, our emotional intelligence increases. We are able to handle interpersonal relationships judiciously and, by definition, empathically. Well, the fifth area is social skills, right? You probably know people who don't have great social skills, and you probably know people who have fantastic social skills. Now, social skills, see, I come from a family, like, we're not all Asperger's, but some of us are, and those of us that aren't, we kind of lean that way a little bit. And, you know, my wife always thinks it's quite funny that I came from my family, but I did. You know, it's just something, it just went different with me. And the thing about sort of the emotional disconnect that some of us experience is that we try to learn to navigate by rules. So, okay, so, and I, you know, I had a client who was Asperger's and actually had a book with pictures. And when somebody looks like this, it means they're feeling that. And that was the best way they could find that they had found up to that point of navigating without being able to get a feel for people. But what's interesting and what I've seen in my own family is there are times that all of us get a feel for each other. There are times where, despite what is meant to be a brain problem, we deeply feel, and we connect deeply. And that suggests to me, I am not saying this is true, but that suggests to me that maybe the label isn't so helpful. It's helpful because it takes the pressure off. It's helpful because you don't feel alone. But if you struggle socially, it's probably just because it's all been a bit too much. And so you've never really taken the time, given it the attention that allows you to get good at anything. And you might start by painting by numbers. You know, there's somebody in our family who you could tell they'd read a book because they came and the book had clearly said, ask people questions about themselves. And so they would come up and they'd go, tell me about what's going on with you. And it was by numbers. It was sort of if you've ever watched The Big Bang Theory, Sheldon is a great example of this, right? He's been taught how to interact, and it sometimes sort of works. But the series did a nice job, I think, of helping him, allowing his character to wake up to genuine emotions and a genuine empathy and a genuine sense of connection beyond the limited social skills and emotional intelligence that he exhibited in the first series of the show. I think it just finished the 12th series and final series. Well, we all have that in us. I know that's just a TV show, but we all have that capacity in us to see beyond our apparent limitations, to connect beyond our apparent biological lack. And I'm just talking about extremes. I'm talking about people who you might argue or hear an argument from a psychologist. Well, this person will never be able to. Yeah, I'm not a big fan of predicting the future like that. I love Norman Cousins. If you've ever read one of the most amazing books outside of You Can Heal Your Life, if you have dealt with illness or dealing with illness, is Anatomy of an Illness by Norman Cousins. And in the book, he learns to just reconnect to his aliveness through humor. And he sits in a hospital bed, having been told that, you know, he's got, I think it's ankylosing spondylitis, and it's never going to get better, and he's doomed for, you know, to be in this degenerative condition for the rest of his life. And he laughs himself well. He puts on movies of Laurel and Hardy and the Three Stooges and all these different comedians from his era, and he just laughs and laughs and laughs, and over time his body gets better and he goes on to have a completely normal life. Now, that doesn't mean, oh, okay, so I need to laugh. Look, worst case, you have a good laugh. It's not a bad idea. But what he says in that book, and it always stuck with me, is he says, when it comes to anything medical, it's probably a good idea to accept the diagnosis, but ignore the prognosis. Because prognoses, prognosticators, predictors of the future, are basically giving you their best guess based on anecdotal or statistical evidence, neither of which says anything about you. So I think it was kind of helpful when we found out there was Asperger's in the family, but I don't think in any way any of us have been limited by the diagnosis. So let's sort of pull back. So we've talked about, I'm going to kind of go in reverse order, that social skills can be learned. And while at first we learn them by numbers, ultimately they're an art. And the thing about art is there aren't right answers. And the more we engage in our art, the more artistic our lives become. Empathy is natural. It's built into us. We are made to have a feel for others. There are these things in our brain called mirror neurons. And I've heard different statistics about the percentage of mirror neurons in your brain, and their purpose biologically, physiologically, is to pick up on the feeling from another brain, from another being. So it's built into the hardware for us to be able to feel what others are feeling, to get a feel for where they're at. So it's natural. It's already built into the system. Social skills are an art. Empathy is a gift. Motivation is a word that we use to describe somebody who seems to do a lot of the things that we think we should do. And if they go against your inclination, if they don't really make sense to you to do, then you use motivation to get yourself to do it. As a coach, I always found it really interesting that one of the reasons that people would try to hire me is to get them to do what they didn't want to do. Now, I was never going to help somebody do what they don't want to do. That makes no sense to me at all. It's like, help me hit myself in the face. What do you mean? Well, I just can't get myself to hit myself in the face repeatedly. Well, why would you want to do that? Well, because it's all the self-help books say that you've got to hit yourself in the face if you want to be happy and successful. Well, yeah, but does that make any sense to you? Well, no, it doesn't make any sense to me, but I mean, I'm only me. They're them. They've written self-help books. You have an inner inclination. You have an inner guidance system. The more you go with it, the more other people will describe you as motivated. The more you try to manipulate yourself into doing what you don't really want to do, the more and more disconnected you get from the system. And the system is self-regulating. Our emotional intelligence is built in to the system. We don't need to apply it. It is already there. And the thing that makes it all work, the thing that makes the system work perfectly as designed, is self-awareness. Noticing. Not being continually distracted and preoccupied by our thoughts, by our good ideas, by whatever it is that we think is more important than being alive in this moment. So no matter how much you think you have to do to be emotionally intelligent, there's less to do. And no matter how little you think there is to do to become more emotionally intelligent, to increase your emotional intelligence, I promise you, there's even less to do, because you are made for this. Human beings are made with the capacity to be aware of, work with, and express their emotions, and to handle interpersonal relationships judiciously and empathically. We are made of awareness, so self-awareness is the most natural thing in the world. We are built to self-regulate. So providing that we're not interfering with that awareness, the system will take care of itself. We don't need motivation to do what we know to do or are inclined to do at a fundamental level. So motivation isn't a problem or an obstacle. We are intrinsically empathic. We are made to feel the pain of others and the joy of others. And most of you, I'm going to guess, listening to this show, that's one of the reasons you listen to shows like this, is both because you are drawn to alleviate the suffering of others, the pain of others, and or because you're drawn to alleviate your own pain, to alleviate your own suffering. That's a product of our shared humanity. And then when you've got all that going on, social skills aren't that hard to develop. They take time. There's an artistry, there's a learning curve. Sometimes, depending on how we were brought up, there's an unlearning curve, where a lot of ideas that we developed about the right way to be socially fall away. But it's like most other things in life. When you show up fully present, not preoccupied, nothing much filling up your head, you automatically connect with others. You automatically have more presence because you are more present. Life moves through you with greater ease. So you not only feel that aliveness, that thriving inside yourself, but it's visible to others. It's attractive to others. Others want to spend time with you because the aliveness in you wakes up the aliveness in them, because they are naturally empathic too. And it really is as simple as showing up and responding to what shows up within you and without you, on the inside and in the world. And that's the beauty of it. If you like the stuff we're talking about, we're going deep in July. So we got a new program called the Advanced Course. And if you want to learn more about that, we've been doing this course for 4 years. We've had thousands of people run through it. And the next one is about to begin in July. So go to michaelneal.org/advanced. Until next week, have fun, learn heaps, and I'll talk to you soon. Bye-bye for now.